Welcome back to the Electronic Intifada podcast. I am Omar Kermi, associate editor at EDI, and your host for today. I will be joined by Abdul Jawad Omar, a lecturer and PhD candidate at Bezet University, where he currently teaches in the Department of Philosophy and Cultural Studies. Today, we'll be discussing all things Palestinian Authority in a week where PA leader Mahmoud Abbas formally appointed Hussein Sheikh, the Secretary General of the Palestine Liberation Organization, as his PLO deputy, effectively anointing him heir apparent. But heir to what? Given that Bezalel Smotrich, Israel's finance minister, has declared 2025 the year of sovereignty, presumably Israel's, over the West Bank, what is there to inherit and why would you want it? In a recent article I wrote for the Electronic Intifada, I wrote about the PA's leadership's waning legitimacy and relevance, a legacy of the 1993 Oslo Accords that, whether by effect or design, has rendered the PA, which was in the 1990s presented as an institutional precursor to statehood, largely an adjunct of Israel's military occupation. It's for this reason that a leaked document purporting to be from the PA's General Intelligence Service presenting a list of measures Palestinian security forces would take if in charge of Gaza and the day after seems so believable to so many. The listed measures in that document included gathering information about Hamas with a view to completely dismantling the movement, and in return for Israel agreeing a, quote, change of course, end quote, in the West Bank. Such measures, the document's unknown author writes, are necessary to salvage what remains of the PA's legitimacy. There are doubts, of course, about the veracity or source of the document, which may well be a fake. But that the document was widely shared online suggests that even if many may have harbored doubts, its content seemed believable. The fact that many thought it plausible that such a list of measures was being circulated, even as Palestinians in Gaza continue to suffer Israel's genocidal aggression, is a measure of the depth to which the PA, or at least its senior leadership, has sunk in the public's estimation. And it raises serious questions about what the future holds for the PA, for its leadership, for Palestinian diplomacy in general, as well as for West Bank-Gaza relations. Joining us to talk about all of this is Abdul Jawad Omar, a lecturer and PhD candidate at Bezet University. Abdul Jawad is a regular contributor to the Electronic Intifada, MondoWise, and other publications, as well as a regular guest on the Millennials Are Killing Capitalism podcast. His most recent article for MondoWise detailed a rather unsavory spectacle of a new shopping mall being open to much fanfare in Ramallah, even as 2 million Palestinians are facing starvation in Gaza. Abdul Jawad, welcome.
Thanks, Omar. Glad to
Thank
be with
you.
You
for joining us today. Sorry for the lengthy introduction.
No,
I hope
no.
You're well.
Yeah.
Perhaps let's start with that article. It was from 18th of April, entitled Palestinian Elites Threw a Huge Party at the Opening of a Mega Mall. First, what made you write this article, and what does this party thrown show about Ramallah in general and what you call the Palestinian elites in specifically?
Well, I mean, I'll be honest, the choice for Palestinian elites and the title of the article was not mine. But more broadly, and perhaps even in many ways, I think, you know, the mall itself being named Icon, which is, you know, it's not a name that just labels, but, you know, also consecrates, and it seeks in many ways to inscribe itself into something quite sacred, if you want. You know, an icon is something to be perhaps followed, emulated along those lines. So there's that interplay in language where this new mall being opened up is also a sign of the way the Palestinian middle class that is tethered to the Palestinian bureaucracy, the PA, or those who currently extract much of the capital within the Palestinian economy, including, you know, people from within the political leadership, or what is called mistakenly a political leadership, also people who are head of security services, people who have invested quite a lot in, you know, businesses and capital extraction and service monopolies within the Palestinian Authority, you know, have created this, you know, Disneyland of consumerism within Ramallah. It's not necessarily anything quite extraordinary when compared to Amman, for instance, or New York, for that matter. You know, for me, as I write also in the article, I don't think there's anything really new in this, except that it, you know, arrives generally in Palestine malls, other consumerist operations, a bit later than other places, you know, that are much more connected to this kind of globalized economy. But I think the fact that this mall was opened with fanfare, as you said, with a sense of shamelessness around, you know, the spectacle, the other horrific spectacle of viewing with, you know, this kind of sanitized, you know, gaze, the daily massacres in Gaza, I think tells us something more broadly about the current political condition within the West Bank itself. And I don't think this is necessarily only a affliction among, let's say, a specific class, although it concentrates itself in this, you know, what the article says, it's the Palestinian elite, but it's simply something that is more pervasive among Palestinians more broadly, which is not denial, which kind of connotes that you deny that something is going on, so you don't acknowledge that it's going on, but actually a form of disavowal, which means that you realize that there is a massacre and a genocide and that you live within the domain of this state that actually is committing these horrific crimes, but still you insist on maintaining business as usual. Mm-hmm. And this operation has a political, if you want, implication, because it actually supports the maintenance of the Palestinian Authority itself through also a political operation that is going on, where disavowal meets, you know, holding the Palestinian Authority, or not holding, disavowal meets or encounters a political and psychological war that has been launched since Tufan al-Aqsa or October 7th, which is trying to actually place the responsibility for everything that is happening on the shoulders of the fighters and the resistance fighters themselves. And we saw actually, you know, Abu Mazen in his meeting with his national council call the resistance fighters and those who belong to resistance more broadly as Ulad al-Kalb, which means, you know, sons of dogs. Yeah.
So I mean, we'll get back to that point in a second. But what I wondered actually, I mean, life goes on, of course. And it wouldn't be surprising to see people elsewhere opening malls and celebrating. But doesn't this speak to sort of a very deep division between the West Bank and Gaza? I mean, it's been, you know, the Gaza has been under blockade for 17, 18 years, of course, beforehand. And it seems to me that if Palestinians themselves are willing to pretend that life can go on as normal in the West Bank, that's a quite a serious sort of alienation, if you like, between the two populations. What do you think?
No, for sure. I mean, this is one of the, you know, truths that have been revealed with Tufan al-Aqsa. I think, you know, what has been going on in terms of Israel actually dissecting the Palestinians into these kind of six geographies, if you want. Some people claim perhaps seven, which is Palestinian citizens of Israel, Palestinians in the West Bank, Palestinians in Jerusalem, Palestinians in Gaza, Palestinians in Shatat, but also Palestinians in prison, for instance, and Palestinians who are in the graveyard, you know, if you want to talk about these various geographies and what they mean. So the dead, the imprisoned, and these dissections of life across these different borders. And one of the things that happened from the outset of Tufan al-Aqsa is that when the head of Al-Qassam Brigades, Muhammad al-Dayf, actually, announced that this operation is going on, he called on the people of the region, but also on the Palestinian people to to join in the struggle, which is part of the Palestinian resistance, let's say a tradition, which, you know, is embodied in this idea of nida' in Arabic, which means a call to summons, to come on the streets, etc. And from that moment, the decision taking in Gaza was, out of sync, if you want, with the rest of the geographies. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think this is where the danger becomes, politically, at least there is something dangerous in saying that. Because generally, most people would go, it's the West Bank people are problematic. It's not about people. It's not about a whole society. We cannot condemn society as such. We need to see what is actually working within this society, why the society does not have political organizations. So then the idea of, for instance, Israel's, counterinsurgency campaign, which is always ongoing in the West Bank, that exhausts exhausts the ability of Palestinians to actually come up with, if you want, political organizations, is one of the elements of why there was no sinking, because people do not act out of only spontaneous action, specifically when this October 7th was such a big, if you want, event that people could not actually, subsume within their whole symbolic and political, fabric, if you want. So the problem from the outset was that there's this out of sinking, but with the ongoing massacres, with the fear that people live under, with the idea that the West Bank is next, with the intensification of violence, with the prisons that have become horrific slaughterhouses, even for Palestinians who are arrested within the West Bank, this is all added up and compounded up to create a moment of, choking. So there's something that calls me to act, but at the same time, I'm incapable of acting. So I end up choking, incapable of actually really mustering or creating any words or grammar or, meeting the demands of this moment in any significant way. And so there's that element of it.
Sounds like you're suggesting there is a lack of leadership, a lack of people who can focus that energy.
Of course, yeah. I mean, that's one of the elements. I mean, it's a persistent campaign, Omar, of actually depriving the Palestinians of any alternative leadership in the West Bank than the one that we actually have to bear in the Palestinian Authority itself. And those around.
Let me get back to that, because we have a clip, I think, of the speech you mentioned before, Mahmoud Abbas. I believe this was at the PLO, but which is supposed to be for, well, all factions except Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and a few others. But it ended up being mostly, I believe, Fatah, that is Abbas's faction, Abbas's movement, because I think the PFLP and the Democratic Initiative and others refused to actually attend that particular speech. Well, I don't know if we can show this clip.
وقف حرب العبادة الإسرائيلية التي يتعرض لها قطاع غزة هذه فعلا يجب أن تتوقف كل يوم في مئات القتلى ليش الناس نسلم الرهين الأمريكية طب يا أولاد الكلب تلموا اللي عندكم هدول خلصونا من الشغلة سدوا ذرائعهم خلصونا
What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, one kind of tragic comic, if you want, thing about the comments is that, part of actually the PLO culture of, organizational culture was actually the use of profane language. And I think this is perhaps the only thing that remains from the 70s and 80s when the PLO was actually revolutionary fidei strugglers who, that they use profane language with quite a liberty. And we see that embodied in Abbas himself, who was part of that generation, at least, still being used, but now turned against those who are resisting. The second thing is that it's quite naive. It tells us that, Mahmoud Abbas, who have invented this concept of pragmatic realism, if you want, within the Palestinian leadership, is actually only in, you know, not pragmatic or realistic. I mean, that's one of the problems, is that, you know, when you have Prime Minister Netanyahu, for instance, saying that even if they handed in all the captives that the resistance has in Gaza, that they will still go on, occupy Gaza, ethnically cleanse it, and turn it, as Trump wants, into a Riviera. And in fact, one of the things that is holding Israel back and perhaps creating a lot of internal contradictions also within Israeli society is the persistence of this captive problem that is, you know, one of at least the cards of leverage that the Palestinian resistance have to end the genocidal war that is going on. So that showed a lack of realistic assessment. It shows no sense of pragmatism, but also, unfortunately, this, you know, use of profane language in ways that kind of echo, the only echo from the 70s and 80s, unfortunately. Yeah.
Well, let's start with that. I mean, I think there's been an interesting, almost sort of an experiment, political experiment happening here, where you've got this movement, Fatah and the PLO, more broadly, which was promised statehood and sort of climbed a few steps up that, which is what is represented effectively by the Palestinian Authority. And it was promised statehood by the basically the West, the US in particular, of course, and the EU and others. And in the 1990s, it was presented as a sort of institutional precursor to a state. But it never got there. And so it kind of has adopted the institutionals, the language, the supposedly realistic realism, that these are the only steps it can take. It has to continue on this path. However, those countries who promised statehood are the same countries who have backed Israel's genocide in Gaza. And so what is the thinking with continuing to rely on these countries to deliver you when they have shown quite clearly that they have no red lines when it comes to Israel, or so it seems anyway?
Well, the sorry thing, Omar, I don't think that they care about the deliverance anymore. I mean, I think that's not really within the horizon of thinking within the Palestinian leadership. I think they talk the talk of Palestinian state, but simply they see themselves as people who govern, you know, remnants, ruins, and, you know, doing it in a way that actually benefits them, benefits their pockets. But they're not struggling for anything. I mean, that was, I think, one of the ideological tools used after the Second Intifada to entice the Palestinian population more broadly towards accepting and buying in into this Fayyad's program of state building and institution building in the hope of achieving a state. And I think by 2012, it started around 2006-07. By 2012, you know, that narrative started to erode slowly, because, you know, as you said, you know, every international financial institution actually at that moment declared that Palestine is ready for statehood. Yeah, every political actor in the world, not political actor, but any, you know, neutral organization also claimed that. The EU, World Bank, IMF, UN, all of them said we're ready for statehood, but the statehood didn't arrive. And, you know, at that moment, you start to have like the slow, if you want, the decomposition of this whole narrative. And the reinvention of the Palestinian Authority from one that actually seeks some sort of future horizon, which is the realization of some sort of state, to a body that only manages what it can get. And I think that at this particular moment, they're using the genocidal violence in Gaza, the intensification of violence and fear here, to present themselves as the only way for survivor through cooperation, through collaboration with Israel. And by doing so, they're becoming more and more shameless in the sense of any pretensions of still holding any nationalist ethos. And we can see that even in terms of how this meeting that Abbas was speaking in, you know, announced appointment of a vice president and a vice chair of the PLO.
That's right. Yeah. Yes. I mean, Hussein al-Sheikh, you know, he has gone through the sort of standard proving of any Palestinian leader, politician, been to, you know, he's been in prison for a long time. He was very active in Fatah during the first intifada. But surely even they, I mean, I look at the opinion polls, you know, taking them for what opinion polls are worth, and you can see that how unpopular the leadership has become very clearly. I mean, this is so the latest opinion poll, this is from the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research. They usually do quarterly polls, but the last one they did was in September 24. But you can see even from the year, you know, the year leading up to September 24, I mean, this is not, you know, in any normal, in any normal context, a leader that is that unpopular that for a year, basically 80% up to 90% want them to resign. There would have to be a reaction to this. And it's not just him. It's him. It's very specifically him, actually, because if you look at someone like Marwan Barghouti, who, for better or for worse, has consistently polled as the most popular Palestinian politician, but who is, of course, in prison and has been since, I think, 2003. You can see that. He is still and remains the most popular Palestinian politician. If he were to run, he would win an election, even against Abbas and against any Hamas candidate. But again, we can see if you look at the gray part, this is Abbas's share of that vote. So the yellow part is will not participate. But again, This is Fatah's standing at the moment, and this is a straight runoff between Fatah and a Hamas candidate. Again, the people who won't participate, or not again, but this time, that's a majority of people according to the polls. But again, Fatah and Abbas are lagging far, far behind. Of course, the last elections we held and not presidential elections where Hamas didn't put up a candidate, but last parliamentary elections we held, Hamas won, right? And I think there's a last slide. Is there a last slide? This is to really illustrate the point. This is without Abbas. And if Fatah nominated Marwan Barghouti, he would largely be a winner, a fairly clear winner, but a winner. So it strikes me that were it put to the vote, were it put to any sort of popular will, Fatah is shooting itself in the foot here. Does that matter to them?
I don't think it matters, no. I don't think it matters as much as people make it out to be, because I think that they understand their power is quite completely contingent now on Israel's backing, on their ability to lubricate Palestinian pockets, specifically parts of the middle class, through the control of bureaucracy. And while popularity might be something that would serve their project of, you know, endurance in the future, etc., I think that actually they're quite you know, comfortable even being an object of people's anger or dislike at some level. I wouldn't say on a personal level they like that they are an object of hate, but I think that as long as they can still control the extraction of finances from the Palestinian economy, still have some sort of symbolic power within Palestinian society, you know, the idea of popularity does not strike them as the most important element in their struggle for survival. they survive by, you know, wielding Israel's baton in front of our faces. That's the basic idea, by being able to still have enough power within Palestinian society to recruit new police officers, create a new generation that, you know, rises in terms of class within Palestinian Authority ranks. So there's like a socioeconomic operation, a symbolic operation, a financial extraction operation. But at the same time, as long as Israel is in the background, capable of inflicting violence, you know, people look at them as a source of some sort of certainty and stability and daily routine. So, and I think, and just to add to that, Omar, sometimes even that operation of hate allows us, or allows Palestinians in the West Bank to not feel complicit with the regime that controls us.
Interesting. Yeah.
You know, like on some psychic level, this is, I'm just saying, a psychic level that, you know, it's quite, you know, yeah, we hate Abbas or he's unpopular, etc. But that, as long as it doesn't become or arise on the street as an actual politics of contestation, you know, it becomes just this kind of passive acceptance of reality as such. This is the problem with the dynamic between society and PA at this current moment, at least for now. I mean, it could change.
We'll get back to that. But it strikes me as it's kind of like a noose that tightens itself, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because the more the Israelis tighten the security situation in the West Bank, the more checkpoints, the more settlements, the more the PA continues its security coordination, which consistently is the main problem that the Palestinians say they have, the people say they have with the PA, the more necessary it becomes. Because the more unpopular you are, the less control you have, the more you need to rely on your security forces. And with that funding coming mostly from the US and the EU, the more beholden you are to these international actors who have shown that even with a genocide, they will still continue to support Israel. So there is, logically, there seems to be no outcome, at least any of the stated outcomes that the PA claims to want, statehood, you know, withdrawal, all of this. It's simply not possible, logically.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a actual policy of suicide, national suicide. So on much of the current discourse around, you know, the existing and continuous war on Gaza and the destruction of Gaza. And I said this before to a lot of people, and I still claim that that Gaza is the only part of Palestine that actually has a concrete and real chance of actual survival. So, even as this genocidal war goes on. I'm not saying it will, but I'm saying that because this kind of split screen that I write about in the article, which is you have a mall opening in Ramallah and you have a genocide going on in Gaza, people think this is safer. Of course, at this current moment, historically, these two pictures provide a contrast. But in reality, if you think of the West Bank as being the prize for the fascist settler movement, if you think of how the PA is going deeper down this trap of delegitimizing itself in the eyes of the Palestinian people, being completely beholden to aid, you know, allowing for corruption and ethical, you know, a lack of ethics to pervade its own system and its own formation of people within that system as well, that this will actually only either lead to internal violence among Palestinians themselves, or slowly will also prevent the ability of the Palestinians to actually really practice what they've always raised as the idea of Sumut. So I think that, you know, in many ways, this is national suicide. I don't think the PA looks towards the future that much. I think they manage day by day. They try as much as possible to maintain themselves and buy time. I think that's the orientation of their policy. There's no real strategy. Sometimes some initiatives here and there by some people within the PA that have some national sense, like, you know, pursuing some sort of international organizations or ICJ or ICC that exist. But also it could be taken away because Israel can pressure the PA leadership at any point, and then these people are like withdrawn from the actual proceedings. But I don't think that there's, you know, there's even now pretensions of trying to actually attain or realize a Palestinian state. And this is what I meant by Abbas not having pragmatism. Because if your program is the realization of a state, then you will rethink your means as you move on and you know, try as much as possible to create some movement politically, legally, in terms of struggle, allow for some sort of politics of contestation and defiance to actually arise within the West Bank, where you're the only real organized force within the West Bank at this current moment. There are organized forces, but they're very weak or feeble or still growing with no real concrete leadership arising from them. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think that that is really something. I mean, it's something they say, but they don't really believe, like the state. Right. They're happy and contained and highly content, I mean, by just managing, the ruins and whatever they get from the international community at this particular point. And this is actually the contradiction, Omar, as well, is that the international community weakens the PA by creating it as a subcontractor for Israel, by financing that subcontracting operation, by promising a state and withdrawing that promise, by not actually holding Israel responsible, by the continued support to Israel financially and otherwise. So they place them in this trap, and then every once in a while you hear a new leader, a new diplomat claiming that we need to, you know, create a reform within the PA, no?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because it's a quite, you know, weird, tragic, I think, joke as well in many ways, that you weakened the PA, you placed it, or you helped, lended a hand in its own delegitimization and what I called, you know, this kind of national suicide. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you still hearken, you still have this kind of nostalgia, if you want, for a PA that has strong support among its people, that can actually represent and embody the people at some level. You know, so that's a contradiction, that you still want to reform it in a way that makes it more acceptable, you know, that makes it more legitimate or legible for the Palestinian people. But you're the ones, Israel, the US, the EU, the ones that are actually, you know, creating the conditions for it to basically, completely become this kind of shameless collaborationist regime that we're seeing today.
So all this stuff, all the the appointment of Hussein Sheikh as deputy head of the PLO, the reintroduction of Fatah members who were previously excommunicated, if you like. It all seems pretty pointless, really. I described it in my article as ironing the curtains while the house is on fire, or rearranging the deck chairs of the Titanic is another way of putting it. I mean, if you're not serious about moving forward, so who would want to be president of the PA?
I mean, I guess some people want to. I mean, it seems that a lot of people are fighting over it and having, I'm not interested. But, you know, in general, I think that, yeah, I don't think it has a lot of meaning. I think it shows something about the historical trajectory of Fatah, the end of Arafatism in the historical sense. It's complete, you know, decaying. I think, if you want Abbas, one. And his ideology of, you know, the permanency of defeat on one level, you know, living within the horizon of defeat and continued insistence that we are defeated people that will always remain defeated. So, you know, we're trapped in this kind of horizon of defeat. We cannot come out of it in any significant way. Is part of that kind of umbrella of what Abbasism represents, this kind of internalization of defeat, the accumulation of capital and financial gain that we talked about, and to some degree, the commodification of Palestinian revolutionary history, like, which I think is part of, you know, this creation of lifeless museum. And in fact, if you come to Ramallah, next to a muqata'a where Abbas, it's like our own White House. It used to actually be a prison and also a British military outpost that controlled Ramallah, then an Israeli military outpost, and then a Jordanian, and then no, Jordanian, then Israeli, then a Palestinian one, and now it's the president's palace. But next to it is actually Arafat's museum.
That's right. Yeah.
So, and I think this is quite emblematic of the PA, because it's long live Arafat, but Arafat is dead. No.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Who
yeah.
really won is Abbas with this, you know, with this commodification that because we had this revolutionary history, we can now expend it in this internalization of defeat. It's instead of a revolutionary becoming defeated and perhaps going home and sitting with his family, it's a revolutionary that still wants to play some role, create some sense of relevance, but on terms that are now different. And I think that, you know, it has completely inverted the Palestine Liberation Organization from an organization that sought liberation to an organization that kills the possibility of liberation. So,
yeah, I mean, it is quite remarkable, especially yeah. given the narrative that we talk, we give each other, we're proud of our history, proud of our resistance, proud of our sumud, our steadfastness. I mean, and there must be people within Fatah who must feel embarrassed, for want of a better word, at this state of affairs, and in this context, when Abbas granted an amnesty to former Fatah members, there was a lot of talk about this being an opening for Mohamed Dahlan, the erstwhile Gaza strongman, to make a return, who is also supposed to be close to the UAE leadership. I mean, is there not turmoil within the Fatah movement and in general in the West Bank? I mean, there must be a lot of unhappy people. You say, of course, it looks like stability, but what is stability in the absence of any hope for a better future?
Well, I mean, I think that I'll speak to that now, because I think there's two questions here. On a political level, like, I don't think that there's an actual struggle that is ideological or political in nature within the PA. Okay, so there's no camps or people with different strategic choices or things of that sort. What we're seeing, even when you mentioned Mohamed Dahlan, what we're seeing is just who will hold the levers of power. It's a much more self-interested, cynical form of power play that revolves around the same option but in different faces. No. So whether it's Hussein al-Sheikh, Mohamed Dahlan, or any other, it's the same result with, you know, minute differences relating to the personality and their charisma or political presence and their personal histories. When it comes, so there's no that turmoil. Now, whether within Fatah's wider social base, there are people who are unhappy, of course, because I think that for many who relate to Fatah, relate to it also in terms of its revolutionary history and persistent participation in Palestinian struggle, including in the first and second intifadas. You know, there are people like that, but they're sidelined, they're unorganized, and they're not forging what we can say as something that could resemble some sort of political coherence that could actually challenge the current leadership and its monopolization of power. So that's on another level. But so there's no contestation. I mean, and that leads us to the second question, which I think that, you know, what is felt in the interiority of, you know, our very existence here, meaning in our, you know, sense of alienation, feeling that there's no future. People, you know, joke about we're next. People joke about saying goodbye to, you know, places and scenes and others. You know, there is a sense that this is the end times on some level. No. But I think that also that kind of play around it is telling. It tells us that people are not feeling good. Nobody's really present completely. I spoke about disavowal, but I think that deep down, in the West Bank, there's a lot of contestation going on within people's own, you know, let's say own discussions and conversations with themselves and intimate loved ones. There is that contestation there, but will it actually become something more political? This is like a hidden transcript that people are, you know, why nothing is happening, or what is to be done, or why we have failed at this particular moment, or to what extent are we sanitized to the destruction and massacres that we've seen and we still see daily in Gaza. You know, so there's all these questions around what does it mean to hold to on work or meaning or family or life or within these conditions. These are things that people are speaking about, discussing, and attempting to create some sensibility around it. But I think that I still haven't seen signs, because I think that this is the monstrosity in which Israel was both permitted to act and continues to act, have, you know, destabilized Palestinian self-perception and relationship to themselves. I mean, it's like suddenly Israel, you know, unconcealed its truth. It's not that we didn't know that truth, we knew it, but it came with this such intensity, with such sadism, with such with taking pleasure with our pain, with total destruction, inhalation that uses technology, etc., and a world that supports and lends to Israel, that it's not a revolutionary moment of flowing, whether it's in the West, Jerusalem, and other places, even in places where there's, you know, an intimate encounter with the Israeli police officer, like Jerusalem, like, not like Ramallah, where we still have like spatial separateness from the settler and the, you know, officer and military, you know, presence more broadly, you know, physical, I mean, spatial separation at least. So you see that people are, you know, kind of shrinking in their homes, etc. But these hidden transcripts are still, you know, part of, I think, what is being prescribed for the future. But for now, I think people are demobilized by fear and by anxiety of their own future here.
What would it take to change that? I mean, clearly, no help is forthcoming from the outside world. Clearly, no help is coming from the leadership of the PA. And I mean, I understand that you're describing effectively an existential crisis for Palestinians in the West Bank, more so, I guess, than, you know, or at least in a different way than to people in Gaza. But often those moments can be galvanizing. And given the fact that, you know, the Palestinian leadership, the PLO leadership, PA, PLO, it's been interchangeable, unfortunately, for a while, is not even invited to important regional summits on the future of Gaza, that the Palestinian voice in such fora has become irrelevant. When is this going? When or will it galvanize some kind of alternative?
Well, honestly, that's quite difficult question to actually try and disentangle. One of the things that we should understand on a structural level, Omar, is that whether we want it or not, you know, there will be a day that Palestinians in the West Bank will have to confront, you know, the occupation, not because we desire it necessarily. It just, this is the fact of life. No, like, you know, resistance, as I always say, is not really a choice. It's not an ideological choice. And people, like, you know, discussing it, you know, outside in the West, I think sometimes think like, you know, Palestinians are sitting comfortably and then they decide to resist. It's something that, you know, you feel trapped. And with Abu Mazen, we find somebody who's comfortable in the hole, in the trap itself. But when you feel trapped and the walls are closing, you'll always try to find ways out of that exit. So I think that on that level, that structural component will always lead to some sort of galvanization, the rise of movements, the rise of new generations, etc. I think at this moment there's a sense of despair, a sense of hopelessness, sense of, you know, it's a fear as well, like seeping in. Among many Palestinians and their consciences, there's also the killing of the camps in the north of the West Bank, which has been ongoing operation with tens of thousands of Palestinians being displaced, new realities being, you know, created. new ways to adapt to these realities. But there are three things that I would think say that are not necessarily as pessimistic as people make them out to be. First, Israel, despite the fact that it has been going with this war for a year and a half now, even more, it did not really decisively end anything. No, yearning. It's yearning for this kind of decisive end for Palestinian presence, claims, demands, for even us raising questions, you know, unconcealing its realities and showing the world its real truth. And I think that a lot of that has already occurred, and a lot of discussions people have already had. And you know, a new reality is also seeping in relation between Israel and its relationship to the world. You know, there's something that happened there, but more broadly, it hasn't really decisively ended anything. You know, it speaks of making Gaza unbearable and unlivable, but people are still finding some sort of form of life, even within, you know, this kind of horizon of catastrophe and destruction and massacres. And of course, people in the Gaza want the end of the war, you know, from the first moment this war started. But I think that, you know, there's still this kind of yearning for this absolute total victory, a victory that they cannot actually achieve, is quite problematic for the Israelis. Despite all their gains and tactical agility and what happened in Syria and what happened in Lebanon, there's something that is also overextending itself, something that is making itself, you know, highly vulnerable, not being able to turn this moment from some tactical successes into a political, a new political reality. And I think this kind of endless war is a symptom of actually Israeli failure rather than anything else, because it keeps yearning for, you know, the end of everything, but at the same time, it cannot really attain that end. So that's one level of it, you know, and I think that should give us something to look towards. The second thing I think is that we're seeing an actual decay in Israeli institutions. In the relationship between politicians and military and intelligence, we're actually seeing distrust. We're seeing some sort of slow implosion within Israel, and I think that implosion is quite also significant, at least to what Israel becomes in the years and months ahead. But in the crisis of reproduction within the Zionist entity itself, and its ability to actually also provision some sort of futurity to its own settlers. That is one of the problems that also Zionism is also facing. It's also facing existential questions, and war is not really giving it the full answers it needs. So that's a problem on their part, and it continues, you know, the struggle between the different factions. The only difference is that what we see in Israel is a politics of contestation, unlike us. We see it happening on the streets. Yeah, you know? We see kind of this vibrant society still fighting for various elements. That's not what we're seeing, for instance, in the West Bank. Or there is a politics, there is contestation, there is fights, you know, that happen between the Jenin brigades and the Palestinian Authority. But a larger, more more political contestation that is taken to the streets, we're not nearly witnessing. And I think that the last thing I'll say here is that within this moment, these moments of transitions, if you want, Omar, it's hard to really, you know, create. But I think one of the very conservative, and this is, you know, quite a leap on my end, but one of the conservative elements of Palestinian collective thinking, if you want, this kind of base thinking, is that, you know, what happened in Gaza and what's going on and still going on in Gaza and the war of destruction and genocide happening, while people in the West Bank and Jerusalem and within 48 cannot meet the demands of this moment in terms of political participation and contestation, or have kind of collectively decided that this is a moment that is too real and they found themselves without real leadership, can really take us to two different trajectories that are highly differential, if you want. Because on the one level, there's this kind of insistence on what we call in Arabic baqa, which is a very passive word, which is just remaining, you know, very passive. Mm-hmm. We're just going to remain. we're going to stay here just by our sheer presence and by being here, we're still a problem, and a problem they will have very little problem, a lot of problems in actually solving, specifically since the settler is always unsettled by, you know, your sheer presence, no?
Sure.
So there's this kind of politics of remaining, politics of not, you know, leaving or not immigrating, insisting and affirming on life here in this various ways, even through this kind of business as usual life that people are living. That's one element of it. And I think it speaks to an awareness that at least among the society here was, if we're not ready for this moment and people fully participate within the horizon of this moment, it could backlash on us without real and actual preparation. So at least there is an element of that. Like, I sense it in how people speak and how people relate to this moment more broadly. And what we need to do is just hold ourselves.
I was just going to say, Israel has clearly tried to make an example of Gaza to say, don't dare do anything similar because this is what you're going to meet. This is the fate you're going to meet. Having lost its deterrence image on October 7, it has been trying to reestablish that, and to some success by the sounds of it.
To some success, yeah. Of course, I mean, yes, there is a lot of successes on that level. But the problem with success with Israel is that success is not sufficient anymore. It has to be absolute. You know, like, if you have fascists leading your government and they're dogmatic ideologues, the threshold of success is so high that they can never really attain it. You know, like, this is one of the problems that they have. The second thing is that with October 7th, you know, this whole ideological shield of the Iron Wall fell. And no matter how much they fill it, it doesn't seem to be full. No, like, they're practicing obscene genocide. You know, they have these allies that are giving them weapons and covering up. They have mainstream media not really highlighting what crimes they're doing and trying as much as possible to maintain this narrative of Israel as a liberal startup nation that, you know, kills people. But we shouldn't talk about the Israel being killed. Despite all of that, you know, success is, you know, it's your own dream of and fantasy and desire. And I think, you know, Israel now, as much as it's being, you know, driven by these kind of calculative machines like AI and algorithms and by military institutions and by planning and deliberation and kind of rational end means discussions, it's also being driven by this kind of base desires, you know? And when you're driven by base desires, you're also not as, you know, rational, if you want, as I don't like that word, but you're not as rational as you might seem. So there are a lot of sufficient successes, of course. If you're telling Palestinians in the West Bank, I'm going to take your young son and put them in prison and make them hungry, you know, because they went on a protest in Al Manara Square, which does not really do anything to the system or the regime. Of course, people are not going to go out in Al Manara, and because they're not going to spend, you know, 2 years in prison, you know, being tortured, beaten, brutalized by soldiers and prison guards and becoming hungry. Of course, that kind of corrosion plays a big role. So that is always part of the picture. And of course, it disciplines people and quiets them. But also at the same time, there is that politics of affirmation that I was trying to place on, even within this kind of, we will remain, we're still a problem, we will not leave. No matter what happens, we will, you know, bear. Because I think what also Gaza has taught us indirectly in the West Bank, this kind of politics of sumud despite everything, you know? You know, that is a lesson also of Gaza. The lesson of Gaza is not as, you know, is spoken about only in terms of, you know, being left alone and abandoned. That's also part of it. It's not only about the out of sync between the West Bank and Gaza, which is, you know, which has been going on for 30 years. I'm somebody who's 36, but I haven't never visited Gaza, although it's 1 hour away. You know, there's that kind of distance despite the closeness and proximity of both places. But what is very fundamental is that the lesson of Gaza for the rest of Palestinians is that no matter what, we you have to insist on remaining, or try at least your best remaining. I'm not here speaking of every individual and every
sure.
But I'm speaking of this kind of collective ethos that is, you know, you know, being permeated, and that's something that actually people registered, and they speak, you know, like it's registering among people. Now, of course, they tell themselves if you know, if they start blowing up Ramallah, I don't know if I'll remain. You know, like people start to tell
themselves. People have choice.
That's one of the lessons that people are learning from Gaza that I think is registering, is that, you know, we can still, in front of this machinic violence that Israel is practicing, the systematic obscene genocide that is, you know, conducting, that, you know, it's still vulnerable, it's still weak, that within the premise of, you know, their smiles as they kill people and, you know, massacre paramedics, it shows vulnerability, it shows sadistic violence. It shows that they're unsettled more than we are actually unsettled, you know. I mean, we've grown claustrophobic, we're already claustrophobic, you know, we're already confined, we're already living here within the horizon. And funny enough, today, I mean, I think it's I'm not sure, I think it's either the Independence Day in Israel celebration, or the, you know, the memorial for the soldiers that have fallen since 1948 in Israel. And fires are erupting everywhere. The, you know, the weather is quite gloomy and you know, dusty, and fires and winds everywhere. And you know, within this moment of them of a day of remembrance or celebration of what they call their independence, there's this kind of scenes of fires actually burning cars, and you know, even that made it into their news as what's happening to us, you know, what's going on, who made this fire happen, because there's always this sense of insecurity that Israeli society feeds on it and continues to live on. And I think here it's, you know, it's different. I think that, you know, we're, you know, Palestinians are much more resilient than even in the West Bank. You know, there is not the spectacle of politics right now. It's quite quiet. People are struggling in their own ways. People are sneaking into their homes in refugee camps in Jenin. You know, people are trying their best to make life happen, despite the fact that for a year and a half, also many Palestinians have lost their daily means. You know, there's still some sort of politics of care happening among people, the hitting transcripts, the questions. So it's not the story that the media feeds, and it is a story in of itself, this discrepancy between Gaza and the West Bank that some people amplify too much. But I think that there's also a lot of lessons that are being also transferred from Gaza into the West Bank.
And this despite the practices of the occupation, and despite, I should add, probably the PA itself. I mean, I think the final question here would be, given its lack of legitimacy, popular, political, electoral, given its unpopularity, given the fact that it's become irrelevant regionally, you know, Saudi Arabia doesn't invite it to the summit, Egypt didn't invite them to the summit. What is the future for, given its unpopularity, what is the future for the PA? What can the future of the PA be?
Well, look, I don't think that there's a real concrete future for the PA, because I think there's two pressures that will kill it. The first is its own hubris, its own corruption, and its own excesses. One of the elements where the PA is actually really pragmatic is that it tries as much as possible not to interfere in society in ways that make society, you know, rise against it. But in I think the more it's financially deprived, it will actually tax people more. The more it, you know, needs, you know, people to be disciplined and more subjugated, the more, you know, the Americans demand from it that it needs to conduct operations, or the Israeli in Jenin, the more that antagonism will actually rise within Palestinian society. Also on a personal level, because we should understand that within the West Bank, people know each other. There's family relationships. There's something around, you know, the culture of family, and you know, somebody from the PA police, you know, killing somebody from the brigades, and that relationship and contestation will continue for years to come. But The reason why I don't think there's a future for the PA is also because the settlers that, you know, live in the West Bank and their leaders, specifically people like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, they don't want the PA. They don't want any, again, Israeli dependency on the Palestinians, even in collaboration.
It's interesting, actually, because we were talking about the PLO falling into a trap with the PA, but in some ways, of course, Israel is also trapped by the PA.
Yeah.
Because it kind of needs it and at the same time doesn't want it.
Yeah. So it's caught in that bind. And I think that the fascists that are leading Israel now, they simply, you know, want to be liberated from that bind, from having the PA claim that, you know, it's Palestine, hold a flag or represent or embody something about Palestinian life. But not only that, also because they don't want Palestinians here at all. And any dependence on the Palestinians is frowned upon, even, again, in collaboration or, you know, complete cooperation. So, you know, your employer, the one who actually, you know, lubricates you financially, also is thinking of firing you. That's what's happening with the Palestinian Authority as well. Or is asking you to reform yourself, but slowly he's also thinking of how he can get rid of you. So that politics from within Palestinian society, the politics coming also from, you know, Trumpism and the rise of new right-wing governments across the West and these movements, but also within Israel itself, tells me that the PA is not, you know, going to last for a long time, at least if I'm, you know, if I'm able to do this kind of historical projection. I think this is why it kind of also on some level it realizes this. And for those leaders within the PA, they act, you know, that the end at some point is soon. They've already prepared themselves contingency plans for themselves and families outside of Palestine. Most of them have these contingency plans. But beyond that element, the element that is truly is that this is, you know, there's the game and we're going to try as much as possible to keep it going on until it's game over. So, you know, that's their thinking. And that's why they don't have a political program, a strategy, a thinking beyond continuing with the habits and the habitualization of cooperation and collaboration as we move on.
And that is why we see hubristic things like the opening of that mega mall that you wrote about. I think that's a good place to leave it. Slightly despondent, I must admit, but there you go. Thank you, Abdul Jawad Omar, for joining us the podcast, and I hope we get to have another conversation soon. Very interesting.
Thank you, Omar. Glad to be with you.